This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
There's Julia Wheeler and Megan Hines.
Thank you. There's one we made earlier. I'll just put that behind for a moment. Hello and welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival. Thank you very much for being here and hearing everything that Megan's got to tell us about survival in the wild. But the brilliant thing about her book is that there are lots of top tips for everyday survival as well. So I want to start by just picking out a part of the dedication in here, which is to anybody questioning their inner strength, you are stronger than you believe right now. It's a lot about attitude, isn't it?
It's all about attitude. I've realised sort of over the years through sort of guiding clients and working with TV crews all over the world to some pretty exciting environments that actually it all comes down to mindset. You know, the physicality is definitely important, but certainly the mindset always wins out. You know, I've seen it in action with sort of people achieving like stuff that they just had no idea that they were capable of, and like sharing those experiences with people is just incredible.
So when people go out there into the wild or into their own wild, if you like, what is the mindset that we ought to have?
So I think when you're going out into the wilderness or into sort of any environment really, it's having the resilience, and this is what this was one of the things that sort of inspired me to write Mind of a Survivor, was down to the questions of, you know, what is it that makes somebody resilient, and are there certain traits that make somebody resilient, and are those things traits that anybody can learn? Do we all have them? And through sort of looking into my clients that I've sort of guided over the years, and sort of other people, other adventurers and explorers and survivalists that get out there, there are definitely certain traits that actually make somebody more prone to survival than others. And yes, all of these traits are definitely learnable. And you know, by putting in a bit of time and effort, you can actually develop these things. Things like empathy, so understanding the way other people think, understanding yourself as well, and understanding the natural environment around you and your impact on that and the effect that it has on you in return as well. Things like acceptance, open-mindedness as well. And sort of when I talk about acceptance, that's not accepting, you know, your fate. It's accepting the situation you're in that allows you to kind of step back. So if you're kind of like up against like a door, it's this locked door, and you're hammering at that door and you just cannot get through it, it's fine. It's just accepting, right, this door's locked. And then suddenly it's like this amazing sort of feeling comes over you, and you can actually step back, and you actually suddenly see that there's these windows on either side that open that you can climb in through.
But often you're so sort of focused on getting through that door, metaphorically, that you don't notice that there are other options. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think there's something that I've seen like from talking to my clients, is that there is so much sort of stress and anxiety in our everyday lives. It comes from lots and lots of different angles, and you know, there definitely is a rise in people who are being diagnosed with depression and anxiety, and there's definitely a rise in people suffering from stress. And it's very hard, I think, sometimes to pinpoint that one thing that it's coming from. And people are just overwhelmed, and they don't really know why, and don't really know how to deal with it. Whereas I find, in the wilderness, when I'm taking people out, if you stand somebody on top of a cliff, you can understand why that person's afraid. You can understand where the stress is coming from. And I think that then, sort of, if you can get that person to kind of talk through the emotions that they're experiencing in that environment, and in that sort of safe environment that you create as a guide for them, and talk them through it and encourage them, and you know, eventually get them to rappel or jump off of it into the water below, is that that just gives them such an amazing sense of accomplishment and confidence in the ability to be able to deal with stress when you know exactly where it's coming from. And then you can take those experiences and bring them into everyday life, into maybe the office environment where they are just bombarded by all this stress.
So when you've got that situation and you're trying to encourage someone to take that step, quite literally, how much of that is telling them or talking to them, and how much of it is actually listening to them? And therefore understanding what it is that's stopping them.
Yeah, so I think what I figured with resilience is that resilience isn't something that you can train. Like I can't train or I can't give resilience to somebody. It's something that has to come from yourself. You have to make those steps. So my leadership style when I'm out with my clients is very much about them discovering and putting the puzzle together, if that makes sense, and maybe sowing the seed of thought that actually gets them to question the way that they view the world or view themselves. And it's just incredible. Like some of the experience I've shared with people, like, you know, summiting mountains or, you know, surviving for weeks on end in the jungle, deserts, like with like very little things like a machete and like maybe a medical pack just in case, and just seeing like these people achieve it, it's like literally life-changing. I still get emails like and letters like, you know, 10 years since like a trip, of people like still talking about that trip, like that happened like 10 years ago. Like this is like how powerful like the natural environment can be.
And lots of the people that you take out on private expeditions, they come to you after they've perhaps had a life-changing incident, or perhaps there's been some bad luck in their life or whatever. So you're not necessarily starting from a level playing field. Sometimes you're having to bring them up, really.
Yeah, so I see like a whole range of people. So I guide people who are already super experienced. So, you know, we can really go off and push like physical and mental limits within that. Because they've already got sort of the technical skills behind them to be able to go out and do that, and then it's a case of just pushing them harder. To people that, yeah, have sort of no sort of outdoor experience but have a goal in mind, and I would work with them to sort of get them up to a level where we can then take them out into the wilderness and push them out there.
And the ones that are more experienced, I should imagine that in some ways is more difficult because they potentially think that they know what they're doing.
At times, yeah. So I'm obviously, when I first started, because I've been working in the outdoor industry since I was 15. So I've been looking after taking people out for a long time, and I did find like sort of initially, because I was a young female, that so people have expectations, and you know, I'm very, very reluctant to use any terms like sexism and things like that, because I think change happens very, very slowly. And you need to expose people to change. You know, you need to just show people that there are alternatives. And, you know, so that's kind of how I've worked sort of myself. It's just by getting out there and doing it and taking my clients. But, yeah, certainly there have been situations. Like, I used to teach off-road driving in the Lake District. And, like, I mean, you could probably imagine sort of the clientele that we had, sort of like petrol head guys. And sort of in my early 20s, like taking these guys out, taking them through the green lanes, and they, you know, they wouldn't necessarily listen to me initially because it's like, what does this woman know about this, about driving? So I'd take them out, those guys particularly, and put them into a situation where they'd get the vehicle stuck, and then they'd rock backwards and forwards, and they'd get this vehicle more and more stuck, and they'd be like, just sit there and wait, and they'd be like, okay, here we go, and then talk them through it, and out they go. And after that, it was they would then listen. But it's sowing that seed. I mean, I was working in Bulgaria a few months ago, and you know, I was working with a local guide out there who was assisting me. And at the end, he comes up to me and he says, "I'm a man, you're a woman, but I can't keep up with you. Like, I must try harder." Like, yeah. So you still see that. But the way I see that is then you've just sowed that sort of seed of thought in that guy's mind. So next time he comes across it, or, you know, with his daughters, it's going to be much more open-minded.
And let's say we do sometimes get macho women as well.
Oh, for sure. And actually, it's actually women that I've had more issues with on expeditions than I have with guys. So, you know, women can at times be very competitive, you know. And I think, again, that probably comes down to the fact that they used to, you know, maybe operating in a male-dominated environment and used to being the only woman and dealing with men. And actually then, you know, dealing with a female who's actually in a position of responsibility can maybe sometimes be a bit awkward.
Can it teach empathy?
Well, it's interesting. Like, this was something that I was really fascinated in. It's like, why empathy makes up a survival trait. And it's in my travels, it's something that like I use a huge amount of. I think it keeps me safe, and I'm at times I'm sure it's kept me alive, because it's an understanding of that somebody else thinks in a different way, or that they might be acting in a certain way because they've got ulterior motives. And it keeps you much more open-minded to sort of other people's motivations and sort of what they're up to in regards to, you know, how I interact with them. There is studies where they have been working with children with autism and things to try and teach them empathy. So yes, you can to some extent teach it, but I think it's, you know, it's a conscious decision, I think, to actually get out there and understand other people. And I think, you know, in the environment that we live in now, it's very, very competitive. Often people maybe switch off from that.
And so you must see, as well as people fulfilling their potential, you must see, if you take people for a 2 or 3 week expedition, a change in them, don't you?
Yeah, for sure.
For some of them, I mean, maybe not all of them, but are there people that you've kind of thought, well, I didn't think A, you'd get there, or B, you'd say thanks?
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, you often see sort of, yeah, taking people out, they go through this emotional journey, and it's absolutely incredible to follow that with them. So they come in, and they might be doubting themselves and their own abilities, and then you take them through this journey and you're accompanying them with it. And at the end, yeah, they've achieved their goal, and they've achieved their sort of, yeah, once in a lifetime experience. And that's incredible to share with somebody, for sure.
I mean, you speak with so much passion, and the book is full of passion and inspiration. How did you get this job? I mean, it is your perfect job, isn't it?
It is. It's amazing. It's so when I was growing up, I had no idea that there was any sort of career path outside of academia. My parents came from a very academic background and worked very hard to get to where they were. So there was a lot of pressure on me as the oldest to sort of follow in their footsteps and take that road. But I found it very, very hard to sit still. I found myself like staring out of the window at the mountains and like sort of the hills behind where I was at school, and sort of skipping lessons to go off on my bike. And I discovered mountain biking quite early on and was just obsessed. Like, I remember, like, I was cycling home from school one day on my dad's really old bike. It had like a basket on the back, and I was cycling home, and I was wondering if I could cycle along the hills behind the house. And so I took the bike up there, and I remember like coming down this one path, like totally out of control, like the brakes didn't really work, the basket had fallen off the back and was kind of dragging along behind me. And I was just like, in that moment, it was just like, wow, like, this is what it's all about. It was like that adrenaline and that, like, you know, it was suddenly all about me and finding my limits. So from then, every day I was then out on my bike or running. I discovered running about the same time, and I was pushing myself to see how far I could go and, you know, what I could achieve, what I could ride up or ride down. So I suppose that kind of set the scene for what I do now.
And what sort of qualifications do you need for what you do now?
So I picked up my qualifications very early on. So I picked up my things like sort of my mountain leader, rock climbing, I'm a ski instructor, sort of medical stuff, off-road driving as well. And I picked those up very young. So I was then, actually, that's the way I paid for myself to go through university, was actually by taking people out in the mountains. When I was coming up to sort of graduation, I actually ended up with an apprenticeship in bushcraft and survival. So I spent a couple of years with this company in the Lake District, training as a bushcraft and survival instructor, and with them then started leading expeditions. And then at some point, it was about 10 or 11 years ago now, I got contacted by the team from Bear Grylls, who were looking for consultants that could actually tick all those boxes. So the expedition leading, the rope rigging, you know, the bushcraft and survival. So came on board with the original Man vs. Wild shows that he was doing, and I've been working in the TV industry ever since.
So that was a great gig to get.
It was amazing, yeah. It was so, so lucky, because at the time it was very unique to have that set of skills. You know, you were either sort of like a climber or a mountaineer or a paddler, or the bushcraft and survival stuff was quite new and upcoming at the time. So I was very, very fortunate to have had like that sort of random set of experiences, I suppose, that allowed me to step into that.
And so what's the atmosphere within a team like that? I mean, is everybody kind of, I know what I'm doing, or actually you've got a team that has got different elements to it, and that's why it works?
Yeah, so within the TV world, so basically what I do within sort of the TV side of things is that I get sent out, so I have a chat with the production company or with the channel who have a concept for a show. Because I've now got a sort of a huge portfolio of places that I've travelled to and in-country fixers and agents and things, I'll then put forward locations that kind of match the idea behind the show. And then I will go out. So I'm actually off to Switzerland this evening to scout locations for a new show that we've got with Netflix. So it's going out looking for sort of places we can do, like this one's going to be like big stunts and survival stuff. And then the director will come in and they'll kind of wrangle what I found into a show, and then we'll start filming, and then I'm doing the sort of the safety. So yeah, some of these guys, that like the camera guys and the sound guys, I've been working with them now for like 10 years, so we go all over the world together, so it's really nice like catching up with them, and we've become a really tight unit, and it makes my job a lot easier when I'm doing the safety for them, because I know exactly how each one of them acts and reacts within the environment, so I know who needs to be clipped on quicker than others because they're about to do something silly.
I should imagine there's real camaraderie, isn't there?
There really is, yes. Yeah. And actually, it's amazing because, yes, you do occasionally get the odd big ego coming in, but really, like, most of the guys are very humble because we are operating in, like, very dangerous environments at times. You know, like, just for Christmas, I was out in Kenya, and myself and my partner, Stani, who does the same work as I do, and this, another guy, we'd been rigging in a gorge, and we actually got caught in the crossfire between two warring tribes and local rangers that had set up an ambush directly above where we were working. So I'd been rigging one side and the guys had been rigging the other, and I'd actually just been taking photos of the rigging because we were coming in the next day with some quite major Hollywood celebrity to film. So I'd been taking pictures of the rigging because we move so fast that you have to kind of take the pictures so that I know exactly where all my rigging goes. And I was just taking these photos, and suddenly like this volley of gunfire went off, and it was like the sand exploded next to me. It was like something out of a Hollywood movie. So I like kind of dived behind this rock. I was like getting yourself like under, calming yourself down, like because my initial thought was like somebody shooting at me, and I realised that it was actually going to be safe because the gunfire was coming towards the side of the gorge I was on. So I figured in that moment the safest place was to get over to where Stani and this other guy were, where they were rigging the other side. So I was kind of like run and slide down this rock face into this river, which a couple of days before, like a couple of locals had actually been eaten by crocodiles in there. So I'm like running through this river and like climbing up the other side to get into this cave, where we were then in this cave for about 15 minutes with like rounds ricocheting off the roof above us. Yeah.
And what's going through your mind?
Well, I mean, people always ask me this, and like I think at the time, like that, it's that initial thing, you know, when like we've all had that when somebody jumps out on you, it's that initial like fight or flight reaction where sometimes some people fall to the floor and others, you know, are ready to fight or run. And it's in that split second that you have to be able to control yourself. You have to be able to calm yourself down, take a deep breath. And then after that, I actually don't really have that much of an emotional response because it's all about survival. Like you're in this situation. There's no way out. You have to be able to deal with it. So I tend to, like I write about it in my book, is that I tend to separate out those emotions. So I put them into what I call like a mental box. So I move those emotions out of the way so that I can actually just focus on the here and now. And that's particularly important because like in these environments, I'm looking after other people. You know, I cannot afford to fall apart because I'm not only putting myself at risk, I'm putting my clients or the film crews at risk.
So how have you trained yourself to put those negative emotions in a box?
Through experience. Yeah, I think like resilience, that was the sort of key point that came out of my research and the sort of readings for the book, is that resilience comes from exposure to lots of different experiences. It comes from the confidence that facing challenges gives you. It's just through lots of experience. So if anybody wanting to sort of get out and build their resilience, is to get out and push your comfort zone. You know, it's very easy to stay sort of within the sort of comfort of our own little zones, but it's really, really, it's important to push outside of those occasionally. And this is why I think it's so important for anybody who wants to do more stuff in the outdoors, is to actually then go out with a guide or, you know, hire an instructor who can then actually take you out and teach you and push your limits, but within the safety net that they provide with their vast wealth of experience.
I mean, I can see how you can calm yourself down, but if you've got private clients, not necessarily in a gunfire situation, but where there's something happening, how do you calm that situation down?
Well, a huge part of that is in how you react as a guide, like yourself, because if I panic, they're going to be looking to me straight away. So, you know, whenever I've got in situations, you know, maybe I'm dealing with like a landslide or an avalanche that's gone off, or various other sort of similar situations where you have to react, the first thing people will do is to look at the guide. So they'll look at me and see how I'm reacting. And it's really important that you control your emotions. Yeah.
So. It's a bit like looking at the flight crew, isn't it? When there's bumpy turbulence and whatever on an aircraft. Yeah, you want to see whether they're smiling or not.
Yeah, that's a really good example of it, because you will naturally look to them and see how they're reacting, how their body language is. I've been on really turbulent flights and I do that. I'm like, how's she reacting? Yeah. Like, well, he's reacting. Like,
So you've got fantastic acronyms as well in your book for different things to remember. And one of the ones that jumped out at me was STOP.
Yeah.
Which comes from the kind of don't panic. So tell us about the thinking behind that.
So STOP was an acronym. So basically, so the STOP, think, observe, and plan. So
STOP, think, observe, plan.
Yeah. So when I'm in the outdoors, I remember teaching things like, even down to like navigation, I suppose, is like a good example. Teaching navigation, and it's amazing how quickly, like once you become lost, that things go to shit very, very quickly, and it sort of can't really concentrate. So I always teach sort of with basic navigation is that if you have become geographically embarrassed and you're not entirely
that's a lovely
sure,
way of putting it.
You're not entirely sure where you are, it's to stop, okay? If you're in a safe position to do so, maybe like brew yourself a cup of tea, or at least just calm down, get something out of your bag, do something else that distracts you from that immediate moment. And then actually, once you then come back to your map, you're like, well, you know, it's only been 5 minutes since I last, you know, my last waypoint. So actually calm yourself down. Because there was a story recently about there was a woman who'd been found out in the States who'd been doing a long hike, and her body had been found after sort of three years out there. It was very sad. But what she'd done, she'd been walking along this trail and she'd stopped to go to the toilet, and she'd like stepped off the trail. And then hadn't been able to find the trail again. And I do kind of wonder in that situation if whether she'd just stopped and actually just calmed herself down, she'd realised that, you know, realistically, like when you step off to go to the toilet from the trail, I mean, how far are you really going to be away from it? So 50 metres, maybe? And then that would then allow you to sort of calm yourself down, to be able to put in like a search pattern, to actually be able to cross onto your back onto the path. Yeah.
And then, so that would be the observe, and then
coming up with a plan, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm interested in the group dynamics, because I think this is something that if people are in their offices or their families or whatever, group dynamics is something that we might not call it group dynamics, but it's around us the whole time.
Yeah.
And I wonder how when you... perhaps meet people at an airport that you're taking on an expedition or something like that. Who makes your heart fall when you see that group? What sort of? I bet you're very you've got a very good sense of the type of people that there are. Who do you want to be with, and who are you thinking, oh, 3 weeks with you?
I think like first impressions are really important. And it's like when I meet somebody at the airport, you know, so often, so when I used to do like a lot more sort of commercial expedition guiding, like you wouldn't know who you were going to get. You may not have even had any communication with them because somebody else has been doing that. So the first time you meet them is at the airport. And you turn up and, yeah, instantly, like it's amazing, like, what you can tell if you've got the experience, and I'm sure we all do it, like in whatever sort of fields you work in or spend a lot of time in, you'll be able to assess very quickly whether somebody is what they say they are within your environment. So within my environment, because I deal with, you know, taking people out and actually keeping them safe, I'm looking out for telltale signs that they don't necessarily have the experience that they're telling me that they do. You know, it's very easy, like you see like somebody turning up all brand new kit, you know, the footwear that they're wearing as well, it kind of, you know, if I was going on an expedition, I'm going to be wearing boots that I've worn in, and I know exactly how they work. So it's very quick. Those are the little things that I'm looking for. And then body language as well. That's really important. Like, particularly when I'm working sort of in more technical environments where I'm working with like ropes and pushing people harder, is like I'm constantly assessing their body language to see what they're not telling me, to see if they're actually out of their comfort zone and, you know, whether they're actually okay. Down to things like, you know, if we're doing stuff at high altitude, a lot of people get a goal in their head, whether it's the summit or crossing a high altitude pass. And people have paid a lot of money to do it, and it's been like their lifetime goal. So they're very, very focused on that. And they won't try to hide the symptoms of like altitude sickness and things like that. So it's being able to read those things, because, you know, often, you know, we're 24 hours, maybe more, away from help. So if they're actually pushing themselves and they're unwell, or there's something, or they're not happy, you know, they're jeopardizing, you know, everybody else that's in the group. And you have to look out for those signs.
And presumably people have got different goals. What is success for one person is quite different for another, isn't
it? Yes, and that's it. That's group management is like, can be a nightmare sometimes when you've got people, you know, some people are there because they want to take photos and it's all about sort of meandering through the environment and absorbing like what's going on around them. And then for other people, it's all about hard and fast and getting to the top and things. And it's actually trying to manage the expectations of a group like that. You have to become quite good at that, I suppose, manipulation.
Also I'm thinking from a TV point of view, I can imagine that, you know, the camera operators are thinking, we want fantastic footage. Yeah. The director's thinking, we want, you know, and maybe the people who are providing that footage, not so much. Or even the producer's thinking, well, if this goes wrong, how the hell am I going to get them out of there? So how do you deal with that?
It's interesting. So when I'm taking out clients on expeditions, it's very different to the work that I'm doing on the TV stuff. Although I'm keeping people safe in both environments, within the expedition world, like I've got a lot more, they're there, that people have chosen to be there. So it's much easier to discuss the decision-making process and things. Whereas with the filming, they're there to do a job. So the camera operator is there to get his job done. And he wants to get that shot no matter what. So it's about sort of, again, managing his expectations. And a lot of the time, you know, when we're filming, we're working, like we can't talk to them. So it's all by like, you know, sort of body like waving at people or like actually physically moving them and clipping them on if they're unsafe, and they're sort of managing them that way.
So one of the things that you talk about in the book is keeping your brain agile.
Yeah.
And in everyday life, I know you sort of run scenarios through your mind.
Yes,
so that
yeah.
when you're in that situation, which I have to say you're more likely to be than I think most of us in the audience, that your mind is ready and you can react in that way. And one of the things you talk about is thinking, well, what have I got in my pockets at the moment that would actually help me survive? So yeah. I'm thinking, if we looked around this stage now and we needed to survive, we've got this water all around or whatever, what could you utilise here that would keep us alive?
So if we're in a survival situation right now, and I think like we always like talk about like the first 72 hours are really important. That's like often like what's whether somebody's going to survive or not. So right now here, if thinking about the priorities of survival, fire, food, shelter and water, well, we're kind of quite well sheltered. Fire, I mean, we've got these battery packs on these microphones. You know, you can hook those up, hot wire them, get a fire going. Book is an amazing fire starter. You can burn them.
You'd be prepared to burn those, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, even like down, so things like down to, so something I see a lot is water. Like water can make people like super sick on expeditions and when you're traveling. So I always encourage my clients to treat their water. You know, if they're sort of developing world countries, even water coming out taps, make sure you treat it, bottled water. And when you're out in the wild as well, I know people like often tell me that, you know, they go drinking water out of the streams in Snowdonia and they never get sick. I think that's just luck, really, because, you know, you haven't seen what's died or like taken a dump further upstream. Like those bacteria, microbes and things are in that water. So these bottles are actually quite good, because these will go in the fire, so you could actually put your water in there and boil it up. Yeah, so you can actually treat your water. So I always have a little mantra for water. It's like filter, heat or treat. So if the water's got lots of debris in it, then filter it. You know, if you haven't got anything through a bath or through a sock, and then either heat or treat it. So boil it or put chlorine in it.
Right, so yeah. Water purification tablets or whatever.
Yes.
Okay, what else have we got? I mean, if we needed to kill something, we could presumably break this and it would become quite sharp.
It's quite...
I'm thinking, you know.
no, for sure. Yeah, so glass is actually super strong. So this makes sort of great improvised weapons or ways to clean animals, fishing as well. It would be quite hard to catch animals in London. You'd probably maybe be heading into sewers looking for rats and insects as well. I know there's quite a few companies now starting to bring out like energy bars made out of grubs and beetles. It's because they've got a lot of protein in them and they're pretty good.
Mm. And we've got a boat over there, so that would be all right, wouldn't it? Test that for waterproofness. So you mentioned about the first 72 hours being absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
You had a situation in Kruger where it did become quite crucial, didn't it? Tell us about that.
Yes. So it was a few years ago now. I was working on a survival show and I was literally like dropped out in the wilderness. It was out in the desert with... I had just a machete, and I was carrying a medical pack.
Why were you there?
So we were filming for a Swiss survival show, actually, and I'd been out there for 3 weeks, and we'd just been like myself and this contributor had literally been dropped out, and we had a film crew that were coming in and out every day from like a sort of a base camp that was travelling alongside us, and there was one night where the crew were out of radio contact. I couldn't raise them on the radio. I didn't really think too much about it. Occasionally happens. It shouldn't have happened, but it occasionally does. And I couldn't get hold of them. And we'd kind of gone about our sort of everyday things. So I think this was about 2.5 weeks in. So by this stage, like, we'd just been living off lizards and, you know, what I could hunt and find, a few mice. So you're pretty hungry, like. We'd come to sort of like the evening routine, which was gathering like a whole load of brush and things to build this fire. And it gets really cold in the desert. Although we actually had like 40 degree heat during the day, at night it was dropping down to almost freezing. And we didn't have sleeping bags, we only had the clothes we were standing in. So it was kind of scraping like sort of little indents in the sand to sleep on, so moving all the rocks and things away. So you're sleeping, and you're sleeping next to the fire. And you get into this amazing routine, like when you're out like there living outside, is that sort of the fire will burn for a couple of hours and then it kind of dies down, and then you put more wood on it, blow it up, and then you can go back to sleep for a couple of hours. And it's this amazing routine that you get into. But this one night, like, we'd done this and we'd both gone to sleep, and I woke up as if somebody had jumped out on me. I was like, there's something wrong, something feels very wrong here. So I kind of rolled my head to one side. And there was a huge male lion just outside of like the firelight, sort of walking backwards and forwards. It's like, shit, like, it's quite exciting. So I woke up the guy who I was out there with, and we managed to get some more wood, sort of more brush. It's not wood, I mean, it's like these big scrubby plant things, like onto the fire, and build the fire up to try and keep the lion at bay. And he was joined by two female lions, who were like sort of lionesses that were like parading backwards and forwards just outside the firelight. We spent the night like that, and I realised sort of like how important preparation was. And although that, you know, we were tired, we were hungry, dehydrated, like how important it is to stick on top of those things like preparation. If we hadn't had that firewood there, yeah, I might not be here today. And it's like when the sun came up, they wandered off. But it was just amazing, like, it's such incredible creatures. It's like you see them, like, I remember in the firelight just sinking, like seeing their muscles and just being like, wow, like, incredible.
It's a fantastic story to tell once it's over.
Yes.
But at the time, I imagine you've got all of those emotions in that box, haven't
yes.
you?
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. It's like, I actually, when I was writing the book, I actually found writing the stories was the hardest part. And I think it's because I don't remember them with much emotion. Because at the time, you have to actually just get on and deal with, you know, that situation. So you kind of remove those emotions from it.
Mm. Okay, yeah. Great. Well, we've got time for some questions. So if anybody has a question, do stick up your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. If anybody's looking for top tips about survival, either in the wilderness or just in life, really. Yes, go ahead.
So how do you deal with, like, extreme cold or heat and, you know, just being okay with that?
So a lot of that is down to like the kit that you carry with you. In terms of like going to super cold environments, things, I always work like what I call like a wet and dry routine. So during the day, like when I'm super active, I have like the clothing that I'll get wet and, you know, build up sweat in, or in the jungle, maybe it's the clothing that's getting wet from the rain or surrounding ambient moisture. And then I have the dry clothing. So at night, once I've finished all my chores for the day, I'll then get into those. And I strongly stick to that because it's amazing, like, particularly if you're out there for weeks on end, it's like as you sweat, you're putting moisture into the clothing layers. And as those dry, they're actually building crystals in. And water is like an amazing conductor of energy and heat. So it's sort of really important to actually have those dry things, and that prevents things like hypothermia and stuff. And for anybody going out in the mountains and you know, our own amazing environment of the UK is to sort of really work sort of the layering systems and ensure that you're actually wearing the right clothing for the environment.
And you don't have, the idea is not to have too many things on when you're actually in your sleeping bag, is that right?
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, people always sort of come up to me and like, you know, in the morning, so I had a terrible night's sleep. I was wearing all my clothes like in my sleeping bag. I don't understand it. Well, the reason why that is the clothing systems now that you can buy, for going outside, are very, very good at doing the job that they're designed to do, which is keeping heat in and letting moisture out. So if you get into your sleeping bag in your like in your waterproof jacket or even sort of your sort of shell layers or mid layers, your body heat isn't actually heating the sleeping bag. Because the sleeping bag's not heating you. Your body heat has to heat the sleeping bag to then keep you warm. So if you're putting on layers that are designed to keep the heat in, you're not actually able to heat up the sleeping bag. So it's really important, like when you first get into your sleeping bag, get into your sleeping bag with as little on as possible, let it heat up, and then if you're still cold in the night, then start thinking about putting layers on.
Okay. Other questions? Sorry, there, let me come. We'll just get the microphone to you.
Does your family or husband, boyfriend is scared about you?
So my partner, he works in the same industry that I do. So he understands. Yes, there have certainly been times, but we're so supportive of each other in terms of, because he's often in similar sort of situations.
And how does that work when you're working together?
So in terms of...
Well, like, I mean, do you still get on or do you shout?
It puts a different dynamic into the relationship for sure, like, particularly if one of us is heading up the job. Because I think in your relationships you want that equality. And sometimes, you know, that dynamic's put out. But we know we've been working with each other for sort of 10 years now, because we actually met while we were guiding an expedition up to the Arctic, a survival expedition. So, you know, I have a huge amount of respect for what he does and his abilities, and I know his strengths and weaknesses, and vice versa. Mm. Yeah.
And the other member of your family that you take away is you've got a husky dog, haven't you? Tell us about Tug.
So Tug, she's a German Shepherd Husky cross, and she comes, if I'm working on like non-technical jobs across Europe, she comes with me. So she's coming out with me on this job to Switzerland, go and play in the snow. So she comes everywhere with me, and we've actually got a trip planned out to Alaska, where we're going to be spending 3 months just living off the land, crossing Alaska, like with nothing. But yeah.
And is that for a book or for a program?
It's for myself. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah, so like for me, like the outdoors is like it's a very personal thing. Like the sort of reasons why I started was through my own passion and through my own sort of enjoyment of it. And it's really important to keep those. It's very personal. It's about me. It's not about anybody else.
Other questions has anybody got? There's a question just over here. Thank you.
Is there anywhere on your list of places you would still like to go that you haven't been yet?
Antarctica. It's very high. I'd love to go down there, yeah. Go and do some mountaineering down there. Yeah.
What is it particularly that draws you there?
There's just something so magical about it. I think it's so vast, isn't it? It's so wild and just it's beautiful, yeah. And I think it's such a harsh environment.
And there's parts of Antarctica that once you go, you've got to stay for a reasonable amount of time. That doesn't worry you? You're happy in one place rather than...
Very happy. And like, if I'm outside, yeah, very happy.
Yeah. One thing we haven't talked about is the celebrity side of the TV. And again, we're talking about footage and people wanting to see people pushed, but also sometimes to see people fail. I wonder what your take on that is from a safety point of view and where the line is between those things.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like, I mean, with my own clients, if I was guiding clients, I wouldn't push them to the points where we sometimes take people on the TV shows. like part of my job is to know where that line is. So it's to be able to push people to that line, but to be able to bring them back. So I'm incredibly vigilant on these shows when we're working with people and aware of like the emotional impact that we're having on people, because like it's amazing how fragile the mind can be sometimes, particularly when we only see when we're seeing the TV shows, you're only seeing a small, tiny little snapshot of what that person has been going through over 24 hours. You know, maybe you see a 45-minute show that's been 24 hours. Like 24 hours is a long time for a lot of stuff to happen, and the way that it's edited as well, you don't always see the full story. So. We're always behind, very, very vigilant about making sure that we can bring people back. So get the emotional reactions that that they need for the TV shows. I mean, it's awful. Like when you come back and you're like, I've just made a grown man cry.
I wonder whether you sometimes think that, not necessarily the celebrity ones, but the reality TV ones, you know, where does it end really in terms of pushing people? Are there things that have been discussed in production meetings where you've kind of thought, you know what? No, I don't think that's a good idea.
So I will say no. Like if I don't agree with something. So the key to my job is obviously I'm quite responsible for the safety of these people. Is that I will say no. Like if it's gone too far, I will say no. But the key is to always have a secondary option. Say no, but we could do this. And that's probably why I'm still working there. I often come up against editorial with these things, because they, you know, it's people, creative people who sit in an office and come up with these amazing ideas, and the reality of it is quite different.
But I should think that you've got the sort of budget and the insurance on your side in some situations.
Yeah, I mean, not always. I mean, it's like people always think, assume that the budget is massive on these TV shows, and it can be, but often like it goes in wages to, you know, if you're working with Hollywood celebrities, they're not cheap. So yeah, our budget doesn't necessarily grow for actually making the show.
Yeah. So if any of us were thinking about going on a survival reality TV show, which is the one we should go for and which is the one that we should steer really, really clear of?
It depends what you want. If you want a very real experience, I mean, it shows like The Island are still going strong, and they're going strong for a reason. In the fact that, you know, I think there's something, a lot of people feel like there's something missing from their lives. And it's like when you see these shows on TV, there's something in those shows that like really resonates with people. And I think it's because we haven't really, I believe that we haven't really evolved to live as we do now. So there's still that very primal animalistic part of us that craves that. So a show like The Island, if you want a very real experience.
That's hardcore.
Yeah.
And what about if we didn't really want a big experience?
Well, maybe just go out for yourself.
Just go on Strictly Come Dancing.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Good. Lovely. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here and listening. Thank you so much to Megan. This is a wonderful book. Megan will be over there signing in the Stamford sign. It's got lots about the wilderness, but it's also got lots about everyday life, which is really good advice. So thank you very much indeed for being here.
Thanks.